Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns and I've got a special guest with me today, a man who has written an incredible number of outdoor books. I'm going to check with him later on just how many he has, but I think he's one of the, what I would say is probably one of the people who's out in the Cairngorms actually wild camping in all weathers, at all midge conditions all the time, and he's an expert on long distance walking and an expert on the hills in general. So welcome to Chris Townsend. How are you, Chris?
Thank you, John.
Okay. Now, is it true? Is it true you've written 25 books? Is that?
Yes. Over many years, of course.
Yeah, but even so, 25 books, that's quite a lot of books, really, isn't it?
It is, yes. I'm surprised myself.
So what, you know, you do spend, I don't think I exaggerated when I said that I don't think it can be many people who spend as much time high in the Cairngorms camping in all kinds of weather as you do. Well, what draws you to that activity?
Well, the Cairngorms specifically, I love because of the scale, the vastness. There's nowhere else in Scotland with the same success and openness that you get up on the great plateaus of the Cairngorms. Uh-huh. Yes, you don't get the jagged peaks of, you know, the Coolin or Torridon, no. But instead you get a sense of almost Arctic-like expanse, and I just love that feeling of freedom and, as I say, space.
Yes, I think you're right. I don't think there's anywhere else in Britain that's got that. I always think that, particularly in winter, when you come up over Cairngorm and you look down into the Loch Ann Basin and right across all that wild, wild land, really, that there are very few views, I think, in Scotland that can compete with that for almost for savagery, really.
Savagery and beauty at the same time. And yeah. Yes, I think one of the things is that when you're up there, once you get out onto the plateau, any of the three big plateaus, mm-hmm. all you can see is snow-covered mountains.
Yes.
From so many places, which are superb when covered with snow, even Ben Nevis. But when you look out from the mountain, you look down into the glens, you can see roads, you can see towns.
Yeah.
When you're in the heart of the Cairngorms, you can't see any of that. There is nothing in view except the mountains and the snow.
Yeah. Oh, I think there's nowhere quite like that. It always seems to be a place. I think you have to get to know it to appreciate it, really. It's not immediately obvious, the attraction of the Cairngorms, but it's a place that grows on you and increasingly fascinates you, I think. I think we're at a really interesting time as far as the outdoors is concerned, because there's a lot happening, a lot of fairly controversial things happening at the moment, some of which has been thrown into relief by COVID-19, and other things which have been perhaps being brought about by climate change. And at the moment, as far as the Cairngorms is concerned, there's a big debate taking place on what to do about with Cairngorm Mountain, which, for anyone who doesn't know, is the essentially the ski development in the northern Cairngorms, which at the moment is not functioning at all. I think because they sort of went bankrupt, they're not too sure about that. I'm sure you'll know, Chris. There's a debate, really, isn't there? As I understand it, there's a debate between, you know, shall we re-establish the ski development and take that area of the Cairngorms into sporting activities, or will we go the other way and perhaps look at more rewilding opportunities? Is that a fair an accurate summary of what the debate is where we are right now?
Yes, but in fact it's a bit more complex than that. It centres around the funicular railway,
right,
which when it was established, was meant to bring about a revival of skiing at Cairngorm.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, since the funicular railway was built, some of the ski structure has in fact been taken out. So it didn't do that. Another purpose of it was to attract summer visitors. And then 2 years ago, the company who were running the funicular railway and the resort went bust. Now, it's always been publicly owned. Highlands and Islands Enterprise actually own it, but they lease it out. At the moment, they've taken it back under their control. But the big question is, because the funicular had to be closed because it was basically in need of serious repair.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, should 10, 15 million, depends on who you talk to, be spent repairing the funicular, a mountain railway that has never, ever made money and has only, has cost an awful lot? Or there's a number of alternatives. And one is keep the ski resort, but remove the railway and restore chairlifts. When the railway was put in, the chairlifts were taken out on the basis that they were no longer needed. Since then, of course, we've had winters with snow, the funicular's closed, and there's no chairlifts to take people up the mountain. Third option would be remove the ski resort altogether, let the area rewild. Realistically, I don't think that's likely to happen. There will still be some sort of resort there. What's worrying is the direction Highlands and Islands Enterprise is going in seems to be to turn it into a theme park with the funicular rebuilt, mm-hmm. with zip wires, plastic slides, all sorts of funfair attractions which really have no place high on a mountain in the Cairngorms.
Well, I mean, one of the things that is confusing in some ways is that not only is it in the Cairngorms, an immensely important area, but it is in a national park. And it's part of our attitudes to what our national parks are about. Because it never ceases to amaze me that there are things like driven grouse moors in the national park. And it makes a question, what are our national parks actually for? What do you feel about that?
I think that's a very good point. Yes, the eastern part of the Cairngorms, which is the less popular part for hill walking, is basically a series of giant grouse moors. Yeah. And in recent years, the environment of these has deteriorated even more because there's new bulldozed roads being pushed in high up on the moors. I mean, roads on which you could drive an ordinary streetcar. These are not Land Rover tracks. They're proper roads. Muir burn has been going on even more extensively. And of course, there's the persecution of raptors, because everything is geared to producing as many grouse as possible, so then they can then be shot.
So at the moment, I mean, obviously, raptor persecution though is mostly illegal, isn't it? But what's your feeling? Is that taking place in increasing amounts? Is there a lot of raptor persecution? Are we losing a lot of raptors?
Well, the figures certainly suggest that it is increasing and that it's a serious problem. And it does take place on some estates in the Cairngorms National Park, which, as you said, is a disgrace for something called a national park.
Yes, it is. And what would you like to, if they said, Chris, what would you like to, which direction would you like to see the park going in?
I would like to see the park going in a direction of more protection for wildlife and more protection for the wild areas of the park. I think driven grouse shooting has had its day.
Yes.
And it should be abolished in the park. No driven grouse shooting at all, which doesn't necessarily mean no grouse shooting, because walk-up grouse shooting is a completely different activity. Yes. You know, driven grouse shooting is when you have a line of butts, basically places behind which the shooters can hide with their guns, and you have lines of beaters who drive the grouse towards the guns. So it's a mass participation activity.
Yes.
And I definitely think it should go.
Well, can I just sort of add that maybe people listening perhaps don't know the distinction too clearly. The issue really with driven grouse shooting is that in order to sustain driven grouse shooting, you basically have to manipulate the environment. And we have to cause essentially a huge amount of environmental damage by mule burn and by limiting predators, as you were saying. With walk-up grouse shooting, which can be just a couple of blokes and a dog, maybe, you don't have to. That doesn't do anything like the amount of damage to the environment. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. The problem with driven grouse shooting is it relies on having a huge number of grouse to shoot. So everything has to be done to ensure that the numbers of grouse are there.
Yes, that's right. And well, one encouraging thing which that's happened recently is that mountain hares have become a protected species, much to the chagrin of the driven grouse shooting community, who have come up with all sorts of suggestions, like that actually it would be the worst thing you can do in terms of conservation is actually to preserve the hare population and to protect them. So obviously the converse must be that the best way to protect them is to shoot them. Do you think that I think you said one of the remarks that you just made, and I thought it was an interesting remark, you said driven grouse shooting has had its day. What makes you say that?
Well, at the moment, there's a huge movement against driven grouse shooting. There is talk down in England of abolishing muir burn, not just because of its environmental damage on the moors themselves, but because of the problems of meaning the moors don't soak up rainwater. Yes. And it can lead to flooding downstream. There's also the huge movement for protection of raptors. And mountain hares is interesting because when the protection goes ahead, because it's not fully in place yet, but hopefully it will be soon, people who object to that say there'll be too many mountain hares because there's no natural predators. Well, the predators of mountain hares are the ones the grouse estates like to exterminate because they will also eat grouse. So if you didn't have driven grouse shooting, then you can have more raptors that will control the hare population.
Yeah, you're principally talking about golden eagle. Is that what you're talking about?
In particular, yes. For golden eagles, mountain hares are one of their main food sources.
Yes. Yeah. So let's hope. I agree with you. I think it's not only that. It's you know, I think we're beginning to look at how we use our land and perhaps say, well, the grip and the domination of what's essentially using the Highlands as a rich man's toy. That's basically what it is. You know, we'll entertain ourselves by shooting grouse. But I agree with you. I think it's. One of the important things really is how we use our land, and what have we got? What is Scotland? And if it is not the land that we stand on, and yet we're letting that be ravaged and destroyed. Do you think that how do you feel about the huge estates that still exist for deer stalking? That seems to me also to be after having been this huge, dominating, almost glacial presence that was immovable, seems to me to be starting to crumble as well. You've got estates like Glenfeshie were things that are being done differently. What do you think about where the trends are going in terms of the big, huge deer stalking estates that we've had?
I think the trend is the same as with grouse shooting, but it is much slower. Most of the big deer stalking estates are still well entrenched. And I think the key here is to use legislation, because I think that's the only way to do it, to get these estates to reduce the deer numbers more.
Yeah.
Because the problem with the deer is not raptor and predator persecution, it's not muir burn, it's just that there are so many deer that they gnaw the land to the bone.
Yes.
And you end up with a very poor environment where few species will grow, where there are no trees.
Yes.
And as I say, the key to that is to reduce deer numbers. I mean, a classic place where you can see that has happened is Craigmeggie, which was taken over by the old Nature Conservancy. They removed the sheep from the lower areas, they reduced the deer numbers and sat back and waited, and a whole forest is springing up.
Yes.
And it's absolutely wonderful. There are still deer there, just not in the numbers there used to be.
Well, that's right. And one of the things I've been doing, I've been writing my fourth book, only my fourth, I'm just a beginner, you know, by your terms anyway. And one of the things I wanted to go and see was the rut in October. I've heard the rut as long as I've been in the hills, really. You can hear stags roaring, but actually seeing them engage with each other is something that I've never actually witnessed until this October. But and they look like, you know, you see deer and the red deer, and they are impressive creatures. Even though, as you say, there are far too many of them. Well, one of the things I didn't realise is that the red deer that we see, big and impressive though they are, they're actually dwarf deer, the ones that we've got. I think it's in Scandinavia that the deer are much larger. Have you seen that for yourself?
Yes. Yep. And that's because red deer are naturally forest animals.
Yes.
They're not animals of the open hillside, but in Scotland they have to be animals of the open hillside.
Yes.
So the grazing is poorer, they have to endure harsher weather conditions, so you end up with smaller animals.
Which just shows you what a poor environment we're actually providing. One of the things that's been happening recently, I wonder what you thought about this, because you're obviously a very committed wild camper. And as you know, after when lockdown was eased, certain areas, from what my perception, certainly Brown Glen Moor, were used very heavily by people in inverted commas wild camping. We can maybe talk about what you mean by wild camping. But it has, I think, highlighted for me an issue that's probably been around really for a long time, is that one of the things that we've done with our countryside in the Highlands, it's as if we've held the door open for many years and just shouted to everybody, come in, let's pile in. And so we have an economy which is dependent on tourism, and yet we're suddenly realizing that perhaps the tourism that we've attracted is actually destroying the very thing that we set out to create. That's a very complicated debate, but where do you think things are going in terms of what's happening with the way people relate to wild places and what's happening with wild camping?
Oh, I think there's a number of things here.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think some of the very recent problems since lockdown are caused by two factors. One is a whole raft of new people,
yes,
going camping in the Highlands, who perhaps in other years, you know, they'd have been taking holidays abroad or in other places, but the whole of the staycation, a word I hate, but as it's now known, means, you know, people are going camping as a means of having a holiday without any knowledge or experience of what it actually means. And they're not wild campers in the original sense.
No.
They're not really interested in wild places. And most of these camps are roadside camps. But there's also the question of the lack of facilities.
Yes.
In recent years, the Highlands has seen, you know, public toilets in remote areas closed, campsites closed, car parks closed. You get car parks with no overnight camping and a line of cars parked along the verges of the road leading to it. Glenmore, which you mentioned, I think this summer is a particular disgrace because there's a really big campsite in Glenmore, which is very popular. That is closed until next year. So you've got this huge area with masses of parking space, masses of places to pitch tents, which is empty. You've then got cars parked all the way along the road, sometimes blocking it. You've got people camping in the woods next to Loch Morlaig.
Yes.
And it seems to me that given that Glenmore campsite is, again, it's publicly owned. It's owned by, you know, Forest Land and Estates, as I think they're called these days. Ooh. They lease it out to another organisation to run it. And it's the other organisation who's basically said, oh, it's too difficult due to COVID restrictions to open, so we're not going to. I don't understand why they, you know, Forest Land and Estates hasn't said, well, in that case, you're not meeting your obligations. We're taking it back and opening it. And I think if that campground was opened, it would solve a lot of the problems.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, perhaps we need more, you know, campsites, including basic minimal campsites.
Yes.
Throughout the Highlands for people to go to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, when I started camping and going to campsites in the Highlands and probably the same time that you did, really, you know, you'd go to a place and it was basically a field with a tap and a toilet. And that was it. And I think what's happened over the years is that people expect more facilities, but the places have got bigger. And they've got they've sprouted shops and in some places cafes and bars, and they've got, you know, there's more and more electric hookups for people and but what that's done also is that I think the smaller kind of campsites that I can remember well that were pretty basic, but never mind, they were somewhere to camp. I've actually shut, and a lot of them have actually closed down. And I think one of the things, I was talking to Davey Black, and his who's the access officer for Mountaineering Scotland, and you know, one of the things that he was talking about, very much along the lines of what you're saying, is that maybe it's time to sort of spread out these facilities, which will take the pressure off various areas, but to have them in a lot more facilities, but smaller and perhaps at times, you know, less facilities. Do you think that might be a way to go?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, a good example of that is the little campsite at Torridon, which is a very basic campsite of the sort you're talking about, where basically it's a field. There are the public toilets next to the field, which are open all the time, where you can get water. That's it. There's nothing else. Now, when I first went to Torridon, that site wasn't there. And people camped in the little pine woods just up the glen from there. And they camped on the beach. I did both of those. And eventually, the mess that was being created by some of the people doing that meant that that campsite was opened. And the problems went away. So I think, yes, that could be done elsewhere. Another place where that happened that I can remember was near the Sligachan Hotel on Skye. You just used to camp near the hotel and go to the bar in the evening and use the facilities.
Yes.
But again, this started becoming a problem, and a basic campsite was opened opposite the hotel. And again, the problem went away. So I certainly think there could be many more places like this. An example of something not the same, but that was similar, was when youth hostels started again to get more and more facilities, and you could arrive by car, and the prices went up, you know, and they became more like small hotels. Lots of places then started opening bunkhouses,
yes, that's
and
right,
basic hostels for the people who didn't actually want, you know, a luxury type hostel to stay in. That wasn't the point of it. And I think it can be the same with camping. I mean, I hate the sort of campsites where everything is laid out in regimented rows. As you say, there's a shop, there's an entertainment centre, you know, the grass is mown down to a quarter of an inch high. It's all standardised and formal. That's not camping for me. I'd rather go and stay in a B&B than camp in a place like that.
Yeah, we're just grumpy old men, you realise that, don't you?
Maybe we are.
I think that's probably what we are. Okay, we talked, you know, we know what wild camping is, and I think that, you know, car camping by the side of the road. And to be honest, I think it's what we tend to do is oversimplify issues, and the media in particular demonizes people who have, you know, camped and made a mess of the place or left loads of litter. But, you know, I think we are dealing with people who've been through a pandemic and have come through very difficult times. And as you said earlier, they're just not used to, just don't know to the culture of being there. Now, in some ways, I hope that maybe, you know, some of the trips that these people have made will have opened their eyes, and in times they will learn how to do it without damaging the environment. But so what do you think, how would you describe, what do you think the essence is then of proper wild camping?
Well, for me, wild camping is taking a small tent up into the hills, finding a quiet spot, ideally where there's no sign anyone has ever camped before, and camping there for one or maybe two nights, and moving on, leaving no trace other than maybe flattened grass. So that everything you take in, you take out. And of course, if you're carrying it all on your back, you haven't got much stuff to take out. You're certainly not going to be leaving behind, you know, camp chairs and crates of empty beer bottles and so on. And the other thing as well is no campfires.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the places I camp, there's no wood anyway.
No.
But campfires can be really damaging.
Yes.
And they're completely unnecessary. You know, they're a very light and quite inexpensive portable camp stoves, which are more efficient anyway.
Yes, that's right. I don't know where the culture of having to have a campfire comes from. I don't know. I suppose people saw it in westerns and things like that and thought that's what you've got to do. But I have never camped and lit a fire. I've just never. It wouldn't cross my mind, really. So yeah, but I think one of the things that concerns me, I think it's really important that we preserve, you know, the important access rights that we've got in Scotland, and that we don't go down the road of legislation where you know, it becomes illegal to camp in certain places. I think if we work collaboratively, is that a word? And we develop campaigns like Mountaineering Scotland are promoting their considerate camping campaign, which I think is really good. Basically, just to educate people how to work in the countryside and how to enjoy themselves without destroying it. So, can I ask you one final question? Are you working on anything now? You've written all these books. Are you still writing? Have you got a literary ambition yet unfulfilled?
I'm still writing, yes. The moment, for some months now, lockdown appeared to slow down my thought processes. I've been working on a proposal for a book, the contents of which keep growing and changing, so I keep modifying it. but I am going to submit it to my publisher very soon, which is a message to him if he's listening.
Yes, I wonder what he... Perhaps he knocked over his coffee when you said that. Who knows?
Probably.
Well, listen, Chris, that's been really interesting talking to you. Thanks very much for coming on the show. And I do hope you've enjoyed talking to me. And I wish you all the best with your wild camping and your literary quest. Thanks very much, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.